Here we go. So I'm Rick Hansen. This is December 2nd, 2015. Right? Last week, if you were here, you might recall that I talked about the so-called three pillars of practice in Buddhism, and you can find analogs to these, almost with the same names, in fact, in some of the other great contemplative traditions of the world. So the three main pillars of practice are described as sila, samadhi, and panya, translated as virtue, wholesome conduct. Samadhi is defined as deep contemplative absorption, or deep states of tranquility. And then you have panya, which is wisdom. So if you kind of think about it, we have these three aspects of just about any path. There's the aspect of moral conduct, right? Don't be evil, as Google puts it. Then there's the aspect of understanding and insight, wisdom. But there's also the all-important aspect of experiencing and experiential practice. And that's really what the samadhi pillar is all about. You know, Buddhism, when I think about it, I step back from it, or I think about my own 45-ish year encounter with it at this point, and often is presented sort of philosophically, right? Things change, things are connected, get with the program, sort of like that, you know? Or be nice to people. Don't be mean. That's the moral piece. But actually, the Buddha's own story and his emphasis with people was about experience. This is an experiential process, deeply experiential. And there are two aspects of that experientialness that I want to call out tonight. Last week, I was talking about the ways in which the experiencing that the Buddha very much emphasizes is positive. Joyfulness, lovingness, peacefulness, a sense of what he called the bliss of blamelessness. The meditative practices themselves tend to draw us into tranquility, joy, rapture, contentment. These are very emotionally positive states, loving kindness, happiness at the welfare of others, that deep settledness of equanimity. So I was emphasizing last week the ways in which opening to, enjoying, and internalizing very emotionally positive experiences is skillful means. Today, I want to take it a step further in this exploration of the experiential aspects of practice and see what you think about them. And I want to relate it back to the suggestions I was giving in the meditation tonight. So, with regard to the experiential aspects of practice, there's sort of two levels to it. The first level has to do with what are we experiencing? Are we experiencing anger or love? Compassion, kindness, happiness at the welfare of others? Are we experiencing fearfulness or a sense of our own abilities and a kind of inner peace rather than going to war with what's unpleasant or threatening? Are we experiencing frustration, disappointment, addictive drivenness, you know, greed, gotta have it? Or are we feeling contented, full already, you know, enjoying life without holding on to our pleasures, right? What are we experiencing? Or interpersonally, are we experiencing aggressiveness toward others, or us versus them distinctions? Are we prejudiced in our minds? Are we discriminating against others? Are we holding on to resentments? As the Buddha put it, those hot coals that burn us, even as we cast them in others. Are we holding on to, or are we feeling inadequate, ashamed of ourselves, unworthy, unable, less than? Right? What are we experiencing? Or alternately, are we experiencing compassion for others, empathy for them, a sense of understanding? Are we experiencing, a sense of our own wholesomeness as we deal with others with patience and forgiveness? Do we feel self-respecting? We are, in fact, speaking truth to power as appropriate. We are asserting ourselves as appropriate, but not tipping over into the dark side of the force by moving into ill will, or violating our own sense of integrity and code of conduct, right? What are we experiencing? And the path of practice very much is about gradually shifting. You could think of it the sort of the weight of the scales, moving from, in a word, I'll just call them negative states of mind, harmful, unwholesome, unhappy states of mind, and tipping more and more mind moments, more and more seconds, more and more tiles in the inner mosaic of the mind that are shifted over to states of mind that are wholesome, beautiful, exalted, profound, collected rather than scattered, happy rather than unhappy, like that, okay? And for example, the third foundation of mindfulness itself, traditional teaching, is about establishing a stability of recognizing in any moment, basically, am I in the negative zone or the positive zone? And over time, recognizing the causes of tipping this way or that way, and gradually over time, skillfully nudging what we're experiencing in an increasingly positive direction. That's fundamental Buddhist practice. Different traditions have different methods. You know, the sort of original teachings of the Buddha is embedded in the Theravadan, sometimes called Vipassana stream, that I'm largely standing in, Spirit Rock, Jack Kornfield, people like that largely stand in. There are differences in Zen, there are differences in Tibetan practice or Pure Land practices or Chan or other variants of Buddhism, but the essence is very much shifting over time what we're experiencing in an increasingly positive direction. People may talk about that in a non-dual way as uncovering or revealing or establishing oneself or becoming increasingly transparent or porous to the beautiful wonderfulness that was always already true, right? It could be described in that way. But there's still a progressive process in which your experience of living gradually shifts in a more positive direction. Because that is desirable in and of itself, and also as people, with some exceptions, become more tilted in this positive way, what they're experiencing over time becomes increasingly positive, they tend to be increasingly, gentle, forbearing, reasonable, patient, non-reactive, kind, understanding toward other people, generous and benevolent toward other people. Okay, so far? So I'm really saying that it's okay to encourage the gradual release of the negative and the gradual growth and replacement of the negative by the positive. There are pitfalls around that. If we fight the negative, we just have more negative, right? If we chase the positive with drivenness and self-criticism and comparing to others, that just creates a negative. But just because there are pitfalls around the gradual wise effort of abandoning the negative and the gradual wise effort of growing the positive, just because there are pitfalls around that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. Just means, okay, like driving, you can run it. There's some, don't cross over into oncoming traffic. All right. Don't slam on your brakes in the middle of the freeway in the fast lane for no reason, right? Just don't do stuff that, yeah, you could do it, but don't do it. But still means you can drive in traffic, engage life in that way. All right. Okay, so far? What do you think about that? I'm kind of really giving you permission and encouraging you to engage wise effort, that pillar of the Eightfold Path in which we're releasing the negative and in particular, gradually tilting, gradually establishing, giving over to, you know, what you're experiencing in an increasingly positive direction. Okay? Okay. Yeah. And then I want to talk about how we experience. I want to move from what to how.
What's been on my mind during this last few minutes is that I might feel shame.
Yeah.
Then there's experiencing feeling shame, and then there's experiencing. All of those things are happening at once. Yeah. And I'm wondering if an equanimous person is in experiencing. And so, shame, joy, he's experiencing.
I like that little chuckle at the very end there. That was the best part. What do you want to say more?
I don't know what I'm saying.
I think you're...
It sounds tantalizing.
Yeah, that's right. That's great. That's great. Well, for me, you're starting to...
We were in a cafe somewhere that did lock people up who said this sort of thing.
Well, I think you're getting at, I think, maybe I'm misunderstanding you, this how we're experiencing, which is where I'm headed.
Say that again.
I think, for me, as I understand you, you're getting at the piece that I'm going to about how we're experiencing.
Yep, perhaps I am.
Yeah, so let's see if that's actually true. Okay. So you might ask yourself, from a practical standpoint, because I think that's really what's most important at the end of the day, where are you at these days with disentangling yourself from the negative? You know, negative preoccupations, anxious ruminating, case making against others, attachment to certain positions, you know, drivenness around certain goals, got to do it, or, you know, drivenness about other people thinking certain things or acting certain ways, whatever. And on the other hand, how are you doing with cultivating, growing, that which is positive? Could you give yourself more permission there? Could you be more on your own side? You know, could you be a little better half a dozen or a dozen times a day at taking a breath's worth of savoring or marinating in beneficial experiences so they hardwire into your nervous system more efficiently? Good moment of personal inventory. Supported by the Buddha, you know, disengaging from, I'm going to use a dirty word, the bad, and engaging with and establishing yourself increasingly in the good. Okay? Most of us know, you know, it's good to have something you're working on. Like once one thing to work on in terms of disengaging from the bad, and what's one thing to work on these days in a skillful way in terms of establishing more of happiness. Disengaging from unhappiness, establishing happiness. If you know one of each, that'll be infinitely more than most people. Because one is infinitely more than zero. Right? It is, mathematically.
True.
Okay. Okay, so far, now the how. And this is where the Buddha really focused. This is the radical piece. Because everything up to that, it's kind of like, oh yeah, that makes sense. That's what my grandmother said. You know, come on, Rick. Don't do that. Instead, do this. Okay, that's kind of basic. But here's the really amazing thing. And this can spin out into feeling philosophical, and the best way to do it is to just kind of explore it and see for yourself what you really find, okay? The Buddha pointed out kind of radically that any experience, okay, sound, sight, taste, touch, smell, or, you know, thoughts, emotions, memories, desires, any kind of experiencing is inherently incapable of lasting satisfaction because it's impermanent. And phenomenologically, just as an experience, it's in a technical sense, it's empty. It's insubstantial, it's made up of many parts, it doesn't have any kind of absolute existence, there's nothing you can actually hold on to. That's this radically penetrating insight that's entirely psychological. It's not mystical or metaphysical or cosmic. It's very direct. If you look closely, any sound, any thought, any emotion, any sensation is transient. You can't hold on to it. Right? You can't thingify it. And yet, our animal evolution drives us to keep trying to do so, which creates the deeply embedded suffering in living. Right? And he proposed fundamentally shifting our relationship to experiencing. So in terms of how we experience it. So I want to give you two stories. First story is about our daughter. Laurel, I think it was her third or fourth birthday, and we had a wonderful birthday party for her. Her friends from preschool were there. Jen loves the whole presents thing, my wife. So it was like presents, presents. It was sweet. It was wonderful. You know, it was great. Everybody loved Laurel. She got everything she wanted. It was her perfect day. And then the cake arrived. Okay? It was a beautiful, kind of like a tray cake or like a rectangle, beautifully done. And her middle name is Rose, after her grandmother. And so there was, of course, a beautiful rose in the cake. So people were bustling about, different parents were there, and I think it was a mom started cutting up the cake into little blocks. I think you probably know where this is going. And little blocks. And, you know, one for each kids and the parents and so forth. Maybe 20 people were roughly there. And she inadvertently, or just did it, she sliced right through the rose. So like a quarter of the rose went to this piece, another quarter went to that piece and that piece. And then when Laurel realized that, she totally melted down. I want my rose! Okay, totally melted down. I'm not making fun of her. You know, but you could just see how she was. And so right there, she got everything. Everything was wonderful, but she was really attached to that rose. Now, what was the rose she wanted? Here too, this is where the Buddha is very radical. He says it's not about the rose out there. It's about the rose in our mind. Right? He accepted there was a physical reality. There was a rose out there. There was an ox out there, right? There was water or no water out there. But he's bringing our awareness to where the action really is, which is in our phenomenology, in our experiencing. And you can just see that Laurel had this vision in her mind, you know, of the intact, complete rose on her cake related to expectations of certain pleasures from having that rose. And when she couldn't get those things, suffering erupted. See the basic idea? So you might ask yourself, what are some of the roses in your own life? Where you form a percept, an image, you know, just it's very quick in the little, I call it the simulator, typically in the back part of the midline cortex, the default network, where we're just doing kind of imagining, or more goal-directed frontal regions. We're imagining various things in our imagination, our little mini movies, whether they're the sort of dreamier ones that involve the back part of the network or the more goal-directed ones in the front. Either way, we're constantly conjuring these presumed things, you know, experiences, percepts, sounds, sights, you know, what it will be like when. Right? And then we tip into clinging to them, craving of them, and that's when we start to suffer. Because the thing itself, the percept itself, the image of the rose, the taste of the rose, is not capable of lasting satisfaction. Sometimes it's described as the unsatisfactory nature of all experience. It's not so much that it's unsatisfactory or dissatisfying. It's just it's incapable of giving us the happiness that we seek in it because you can't hold on to it. Yeah.
But if she ate the rose.
Right. It's good. This is great.
She would have been happy and it all
she would have.
Fine.
Yeah.
So that would, then the remembrance of that experience
yeah.
would have brought her joy. So.
That's right. And I would wish for her, wholesomely, I think, that she would have had the rose. And the next year, we were much more careful. So there's a place, obviously, for ordinary skillfulness. And I think of it as the friend test or the daughter test, you know. If you would wish that for your friend or your daughter or someone who is neutral to you, but you still have, you know, goodwill toward, why not wish that for yourself? Why not wish for yourself to have your own rose in that way? But there's such a distinction between getting attached to the rose and enabling yourself to have it without attachment to the result. And that's a real place of practice where there's a lot of exploration. How do we have wholesome purposes and intentions? How do we lean in? How can we be muscular and passionate and determined, even as appropriate, fiery perhaps, you know, or persuasive to a good purpose without getting hooked on the anticipated experience that we'll have as a result. That's so much the essence. That's the Buddha's kind of radical insight. So he was basically proposing that we recognize through mindfulness and deepening insight, including the insights that come as your mind gets quieter and quieter and more concentrated through meditative training, that your experience is just kind of foamy and you can't stand in it, you can't hold on to it, you know, it's just happening. And increasingly, it's not even that there's one entity inside to whom it's happening. That goes to the not-self and the brain material. It's just unfolding, right? So if we don't try to make inherently, if we don't try to make our experiences satisfying, if we just simply relax into them and have them, rather than turning them into entities we're trying to grab and keep for ourselves, then we don't tip into suffering. Experiences are unsatisfactory in the sense of they're not able to give us lasting satisfaction, but if we don't attach to them, we don't suffer. Experience is inherently unsatisfactory, but it's not inherently suffering. That's the Buddha's teaching. All right, what do y'all think about this?
I'm just wondering.
Then I have to tell you a story about myself, too. Oh, then I have to tell you a story about myself, how I started clinging to my rose. Yeah.
I was just wondering how this relates to savoring and creating and intensifying positive experiences.
Yeah. Yeah.
Your brain and how that relates to chasing and suffering and the chasing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, given what I do, you know, I thought about that a lot, right? Because it's exactly right. And let me talk about it experientially, where it's like there you are, and maybe you're meditating, okay, or you're in a situation. And maybe you get something done, and there's a sense of satisfaction in getting it done. Or maybe you're with someone, and it just feels cozy and friendly and loving. Okay? And then the question is, can we recognize for ourselves that that experience, let's say, is one that we want to take an extra dozen seconds with, or 5 seconds with, or just kind of register, oh, wow. There's actually a being over there behind the eyes, right? Or, oh, wow, that thing I worried about didn't happen, and it's not going to happen, and I don't need to worry about that kind of thing again. Reassurance and relief. Maybe out of kindness for ourselves, just like for our friend or our daughter, we'd want that experience to really sink in. We want to let it sink into ourselves, right? Okay, you're already clear about all that part. That's kind of resetting generally. All right. So then the trick is, I think, to allow to stay with that experience while you just don't try to make a thing out of it. In other words, you're opening to it, you're encouraging it. I think this issue is more theoretical and conceptual than actually experiential. Because when we're just sort of relaxing and receiving, becoming intimate in our own body. And we're kind of light with the experience, with just a little bit of encouragement to keep it going, to sustain our mindfulness of it, to stay with it. We can do that without seeking lasting satisfaction in the experience. It's the chasing that gets us into trouble. And it's really tricky because you can watch your mind and it just starts moving into these little mini reveries in which, as you watch them structurally, they're about chasing certain experiences. That for me is how it shows up. I can be receptively available for a beneficial experience, kind of deliberately feeling it in my body, like maybe especially in my back, which is kind of a way for me to help things really land, right? But at the same time, not attaching to it. It's like opening up to receive without freezing it so you can hold on to it. Maybe that's it, allowing it to be dynamic and moving. Yeah, this is really good. And I really encourage you to recognize the unsatisfactory or incapable of being satisfying nature of experience. Say for yourself, yeah.
So coming back to the rose. So you've tried the good enough parenting and making sure that the following year she gets the whole rose. Somebody else might have tried tough love instead
sure,
of tough luck.
You're right.
Now, both of these are equally embedded in a pursuit of the fruit of the action, right? So would the Buddha have said, well, let whoever cuts the cake do it their own way?
Well, I don't know what the Buddha would have said. It's a great question. You know, yeah, really, right, darn. Well, I think what I'm, again, I think questions that are more abstract, you know, and hypothetical are very familiar to me because they're very often the nature of my own reflections and noodling and questions I'll ask. And I would encourage also, obviously, a real coming down into your own experiencing and finding there, you know, what actually increases suffering or increases happiness, right? In that example, just thinking a little bit about it, I actually find that paradoxically, satisfying desire in certain ways actually over time undoes the desire, you know? And I have a lot of backgrounds, you probably know, in early childhood development and stuff, and in terms of the language of good enough parent or optimal frustration, there's not much that's optimal about frustration. In other words, because life's full of frustration already, and actually, very often, when the satisfaction of desire is skillful, it can, over time, undo desire. In other words, if you can really feel hypothetically, a child, let's say, who feels like, you know, life has some cut roses, but on the whole, parents really care about the ways that was upsetting and don't just try to minimize or dismiss it or say, you selfish brat, you got everything you wanted on your fourth birthday and now you're making your mother cry. What's wrong with you? You know, see, that would be not very good parenting, right? And, you know, and I know that kind of parenting because I've received it. And yeah, so you know what I mean? And it leaves a hole in your heart where you then crave the rose, or the love around the rose, or what the meaning of the rose is. So I think that's very, and the art, I think, very much in practice, especially in the Western world, is a kind of tantra, where we deliberately allow ourselves to internalize, in my kind of quick and dirty framework, you know, safety, satisfaction, connection, lizard, mouse, monkey type experiences, so that over time, we feel already full from the inside. We've already had so many rose experiences that the next time we don't get the rose, it's not a big deal. And whereas I think a lot of people who were denied roses or self-denied themselves the adult version of Rose experiences, have a lot of desire or suppression of desire, which is the desire to suppress desire. They've got a lot of desire and attachment wrapped up around the incomplete fulfillment of natural needs for roses. Right? Yeah, this is really good. Yeah.
I understand what you're saying about not attaching to an outcome.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's pretty obvious, you know, and so not wanting something to be a certain way and then getting disappointed when it doesn't turn out that way.
Pragmatically,
But the problem I don't, the concept I'm not understanding is that all experiences are inherently unsatisfying.
Well, the word, you're right. Often it's described that way. Life is suffering, right?
Right, but some experiences are satisfying.
Correct.
And you can enjoy the beginning, the middle, and the end, and then have a pleasant memory of something.
I totally agree with you. And that's where the words actually matter. You know, it's not that life is suffering in the First Noble Truth. It's that there is dukkha. And dukkha is the Pali word, which really means a kind of wobbly unsettledness in living. There is a lot of that, okay? Right? So that. But there is, I think, for many of us in our experience, a certain, you know, frustration, contraction, sense of pressure, tension inside, a subtle sense of not rightness in our life. People report that, even in very wealthy, developed countries. You know, there's an ongoing sense of that. Something missing in relationships, incomplete with other people, right? And, you know, the Buddha's analysis of that, I think, and I think other people think that as well, is that a lot of that has to do with our relationship with our experiences. Some of that pain, discontent, has to do with objective conditions that are not good. Mistreatment, terrible things. San Bernardino tonight. You know, I grew up very near that part of the Southern California. And also, we have, you know, personal issues in our life, or we do certain things that aren't very skillful. You know, we create trouble for ourselves. But in addition to, even if we took care of those environmental factors of pain and unhappiness, and even if we really were Tony Robbins superstars, really on top of our game, you know, in terms of how we manage our relationships or engage work or relate to our bodies, right? There would still be this fundamental level of discontent, the Buddha would assert, which has to do with chasing our experiences to make them satisfactory rather than letting them just flow with a spaciousness and a lot of acceptance and presence in the middle of them. Right? Okay, that was very helpful. That's what I'm trying to get at. It's that third piece that you can really observe just in your own direct, immediate experience a lot. And the way out of it is to really recognize the transience, the impermanence, and the kind of foamy emptiness of all experience. Right now we're experiencing. You're seeing things, you're hearing things. And if you look closely at it, it's a virtual reality. It's constructed. It's like a movie. It's, right? You can't touch a sound. Like, I'm seeing your face right now. I could touch your face physically, but I couldn't touch this. I couldn't hold the sensation of, like, your cheek, let's say, right? Or vice versa. We can't, our experience is not tangible, it's intangible. So one is to have insight into just this quality of experience, this nature of experience. It's intangible, it's ephemeral. It's insubstantial, right? And then what's our relationship to that? For most of us, deep down, is a kind of existential panic because it's terrifying to really recognize the insubstantial, ephemeral nature of experience. It's like suddenly you realize you're standing in air, Yeah. And I think we're really designed as animals to not see this as much as possible, and in fact be deluded, to essentialize our experience so that we can fight what's unpleasant and chase what's pleasant. So to do what the Buddha's calling us to do is to, in a sense, stand against the force of neurological evolution, but to see directly, oh wow, it is ephemeral and insubstantial, and it won't hold me up, and yet moment after moment after moment, experiencing is still here. So what happens then is you kind of fall backwards into experiencing and trust that it'll carry you and catch you all along. And in that shifting of relationship to experiencing, something amazing starts happening. Tension falls away, contraction falls away, selfing diminishes, me taking life personally falls away. We become more and more liquid and fluid with other people, less brick-like, icy, you know, and life starts feeling more and more wondrous. It does. I think we all know this in some way inside ourselves. So this holiday season is a really easy time. It's like the whole world is conspiring to make us chase certain experiences and fight with others. And see if you can just shift your relationship to all that. Experiences are occurring. Some are pleasant, some are unpleasant, some are neutral, some are heartfelt. And meanwhile, loosen your grip on experiences and watch the habit of reification, essentializing, signifying of experiences, and then attachment to them. Watch that. You just see it. But increasingly, and one of the keys to stepping out of it is coming out of the simulator and instead sustaining open-hearted presence. Not in the meaning. How about we just sit with that for a minute and call it a wrap? And don't tell me what happened with the Warriors, because I'm attached to that victory. Okay. Oh, you missed that. Oh, okay, well, really fast. I did not, of course, I'll be really quick. My wife. She'll often start talking, and I don't know what she's talking about. You know, and I'm 4 sentences in. I know she's talking about something, but I don't know the subject. I don't know the frame, you know. And like with my dad, you know, as he was kind of, he had some stroke-related dementia. It's a little bit like a 3-year-old. You have to keep resetting the context, reset the frame. What are we talking about? Right, well, I'm maybe like a 3-year-old. I don't know. I don't think I'm demented yet, but I don't know what the topic is. And, you know, and I know I should care, but why am I caring, right? And so, right. And maybe there's gender here, I don't know, but I'm just saying my wife and me. So I get righteous about, I want an experience to occur in which I know what she's talking about, right? See what I'm saying? And I just watch that. So I want that experience to happen. And the point is, we could be wanting wholesome, reasonable experiences, the experience of having the rose. It's my birthday, it's my rose, my middle name is Rose, you know? I love rose, it's my favorite color, pink, you know? Whatever it is. Or, I want to know what in the world we're talking about. 2 minutes into it, you know, I still don't know what we're talking about. I mean, it's a little exaggeration, but not always. And so I get, I'm going to attach to it. That's what I mean. You know, you just watch it in your own mind, that emergence of that thing. And then, what is our relationship to it? And instead, yeah. Well, we got to wrap up, but yeah. On my part? Oh, okay. Sure, it could be. Right. I would say, in my own defense, I heard every word she said, start to finish, and I still have no idea. Like, maybe that's it. But anyway, okay, for whatever reason, I'm laughing at myself, I got attached to that and righteous about it, kind of irritated about it, making her see the error. So I get attached, I want her to see the error of her ways, so I'm attached to my experience that she's having an experience. Open the hand, let it flow. All right, good. Open a minute of open presence, open-hearted. And not knowing really helps too. Like, don't know. I got to work on that with my wife. Don't know. That's it. She's teaching me about don't know. It's like letting your experience flow without needing it to be satisfying in some lasting way. Thank you. I came out of a retreat. The four-word takeaway for me was crave less, love more. That's a good takeaway.